From the Sky News Centre at 5. Facebook's expected to pay millions of pounds more in UK tax. From April, most of its ad revenue will be taxed here rather than in Ireland. It paid just £4,000 in corporation tax in 2014. Tax lawyer Jolyon Maugham says he has questions, though, about the new arrangements.
What we can tell is that it is a step in the right direction, but I don't see it as being a particularly profound step. It's not going to have the consequence that tens of millions of pounds of revenue flow into the United Kingdom's coffers.
Police in Los Angeles are testing a knife recovered at a house once owned by O.J. Simpson. The former American footballer lived at the property at the time he was accused of killing his wife, a crime he was acquitted of. Police in Belfast say more attacks are likely after a prison officer was injured by a bomb hidden under his van as we approach the centenary of the Easter Rising. The man suffered leg wounds and is now in a stable condition in hospital. A pregnant woman has been critically injured after being stabbed in the West Midlands. Police have arrested a 41-year-old man and praised two others who were injured as they tried to intervene. More than 100 schools were closed earlier as heavy snow fell over parts of northern and central England. Motorists are being warned of icy road conditions while airports are affected as well. Opera singer Jennifer Johnston has been stuck at Manchester Airport since 9:30 this morning.
After a couple of hours, we were told that they were going to consider putting us on the plane. Once we were on the plane, the doors had shut. We were then told it would be at least 2 hours sitting there waiting for the plane to be de-iced. And we've now been taken off the plane again and are now back in the terminal.
The airport has apologised for delays in the aircraft de-icing process but says it remains fully open. That's the latest. I'm Andy Hayes. You've been so good to me. Your love inside me. BCFM.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling, and stuck in traffic is former Bristol West MP Stephen Williams, who's going to help us with the news review this week. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the 1933 transfer agreement between the Zionist movement and Hitler, which ended the Jewish boycott on the Nazi regime. We look at Edwin Black's book on this little-known but very dodgy deal. Also, predictive programming. Is it possible to read Hollywood films to see where the next false flag terrorist attack is going to come from? We talked to Jay Dyer from the United States, who writes a blog called Jay's Analysis. And a US general says if Trump becomes president, there are orders that he may give that they won't follow. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 Celsius, outbreaks of rain. This weekend, highs of 7, patchy rain and windy on Saturday, sunny spells on Sunday. So if you're going out, do it on Sunday. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, sunnier and cooler at the beginning of the week, but wet and windy towards the end of the week. Next weekend, 12th and 13th of March, highs of 11 Celsius, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And I'll start this week with a correction. 2 weeks ago, I said in a 2010 BCFM BBC programme that former merchant venturer, now chair of United Hospitals Bristol NHS Trust, John Savage, had supported a reduction in the old age pension and public sector pensions. That's actually not true at all. I went back and had another good look. Savage did support the amalgamation into the Avon area of various local authorities back into the old Avon system, and he thought that would be a good way to cut costs, but he didn't talk at all about cutting public sector pensions, which the BBC were presenting as the best way for austerity. Actually, they were talking quite a lot about they weren't using the expression cut, but saving money, which is rather contentious. And apologies, John, who, interestingly, he's a mystic, former master of the Merchant Venturers and chairman of the United Bristol's Hospitals NHS Trust, which spends £500 million annually of our money. And it's good that he has a special relationship with God. I was looking at this interview with him on the BBC the other day. He says he has a natural thing that God is with him all the time, and he's able to, I imagine, consult with God. So the BRI is in good hands, perhaps. Anyway, helping us review this week's news, and just on time, is former Bristol West MP Stephen Williams. Hi, Stephen, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
So, anyway, I thought we'd start by talking about Bristol Green Capital. Actually, I'll leave it to you, Martin, to introduce the subject, because it's something like £7 million of public money, which has gone into some kind of holding company, was spent over for Bristol 2015, and freedom of information requests don't work. We don't actually know how that money was spent, a lot of it.
Well, I can't claim that I'm an expert on this, but I have been hearing from various people we've had on the show that the creation of a arm's-length company means that they're not actually under freedom of information legislation, and therefore they don't have to account for how the money's been spent. And, you know, obviously that's not really satisfactory, but I suspect that Stephen knows a bit more about this than I do.
My first question to you, Stephen, is how's the traffic out there?
The traffic is absolutely horrendous. If you're trying to get from St Andrews to Easton, you may as well give up.
One of the questions which about the commission, we're told there's a year of traffic chaos in Bristol because of the Metro.
Another year. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a whole, well, I mean, particularly since the end of Bristol Green Capital, now we've got to sit in traffic jams and sniff pollution for a year. Is that there doesn't seem to be any real evidence that the congestion that Metrobus is going to save over the next 10-15 years, if it manages to make it that far, is anywhere close to the congestion that building it seems to be causing.
Absolutely. I mean, I constantly run into people now who are complaining that it takes forever to get from, say, Bishopston to College Green, whatever, just to get down Park Street. So there's quite a lot of congestion. And I think Bristol has always suffered from this. And hopefully Metrobus will provide part of the solution. But I think people might be justified in being a bit sceptical.
We were living on a bit of a knife edge anyway, trying to get home back in the old days. But now, with all these extra roadworks, it just seems, I mean, as if, actually what's happening, I think, is that the rush hour is starting earlier and finishing later because people are trying to get around that real congestion time from about 4:30 up until about 6.
Yeah, there's a lot of problems. It's not just the recent roadworks. There's the fact that a lot of children get driven to school and not necessarily, of course, to their local school. I think that's a huge part of the problem as well. And if we could get more people to go to their local school and more people to walk to school, or perhaps if they have to go by car, to car share, I think that would make a huge difference.
But can't they pay those lovely first bus fares? Because we've been discussing over the last few weeks about how First Group has got a massive debt in the United States it's trying to service, and actually it almost went bankrupt. It was almost junked by the ratings agencies in the US, and what they did is they robbed a whole load, well, I shouldn't say robbed, probably borrowed, is more apt, a vast amount of money from the First Group's pension fund, and then they were sort of stable again. But most of the money we seem to be paying on our bus fares nowadays is going towards servicing the debt of First Group in the US, who made a bit of a dodgy purchase about 10 years ago. And it's not really... I mean, back in the old days, of course, the Bristol Corporation buses, if they made a bit of a profit, it would go back to Bristol Corporation. But nowadays, it's just going to service the debt, so it's going back to the banksters.
Yeah, although I think bus privatisation happened when I was in primary schools. It's going to be pretty hard to roll that back. What's needed in Bristol is what they have in London and most other sort of metropolitan areas, and that's a sort of transport authority with real teeth, which we don't have here because of the fragmented nature of what used to be Avon, on which I was a councillor over 20 years ago now. We can't regulate bus routes or fares because pretty well every single bus route, other than the 8 and 9 and the 24, I think, crosses the city boundary off into South Gloucestershire or into North Somerset or Bath, and for that reason we can't regulate either their routes or their fares. What's needed is a sort of transport for Bristol, just like Boris Johnson controls transport for London. You can regulate the fares, regulate the routes, regulate the times, all sorts of things. And you know, one of the issues that's been flying around recently, I think you might be talking about this later on in the show, is the arena. And if you think traffic congestion around the city centre is bad at the moment, once you have potentially 12,000 people pouring out of a concert several times a week at various times in the evening, I think things will be even more chaotic.
Tell us a bit about the work you've been doing around Bristol Green Capital, though, Stephen. I mean, I personally think it's really sterling work because one of the things that we like to see, I mean, is at least, I mean, most of us resent paying taxes if we think, and I think this was maybe said on Question Time, BBC Question Time last night, is we like to know that the taxes have been widely spent, and the less wisely they're being spent, the less we want to pay them. And one of the very important parts of that is transparency and accountability, is where that money's going, and that's simply not been happening with Bristol 2015.
Absolutely. I'm getting increasingly furious about this, about the Mayor Ferguson and his chief executive, Nicola Yates, of the council, digging their heels in and refusing to be open and transparent with the people of Bristol about the £1 million that is definitely their money, is council taxpayers' money in Bristol that went into Bristol 2015, and the £7 million that came from national government that I helped secure for the city that comes from all of us as income tax payers. They've disclosed some information, and they think this is enough. So just to give you an example, they say £245,000 was spent on Bristol Green Capital's website and digital presence. But they won't tell us who got that contract, and people who work in the software industry tell me that £250,000 is actually a lot of money for a very straightforward website.
Okay, look, I'm going to put out an appeal. If there's any hackers out there that can drill back into the internet using the Wayback Machine or whatever to find out which company it was that built that, and maybe that's feasible to do.
People have tried. I mean, normally, you know, on any website you look at, there is a publisher and a host and information about who hosts it. You find out all sorts of information. And given this is a publicly funded website to promote an event that was in the public good, Bristol's year as European Green Capital, it is astounding that it is a secret as to who actually got paid to create that website. And that leads to all sorts of questions and speculation as to who that individual or that firm may have been and why they don't want us to know. But that's just one example of many, and it's shameful, really. I mean, people expect more transparency from politicians and from business, and Bristol ought to be an exemplar rather than a pretty dreadful example.
I mean, when these checks and balances aren't there, you start to get cronyism, and you start to get a little tiny elite club dishing out public money to their mates. One of the things that Bristol Cable pointed out just in the run-up to the 2015 year was that Andrew Garrard, who's the chair of Bristol 2015 Limited Board, is also a trustee of the Centre for Sustainable Energy, which receives nearly £100,000 from the Strategic Grants Fund. Alice Ferguson, the mayor's daughter, is set to receive £41,000 for her charity Playing Out. Another board member, Malcolm Shepherd, working as CEO of Sustrans, getting £132,000. Now, I mean, as far as I know in company law, if any kind of award like this is made, whoever's sitting on the board has to leave the room.
Yes, and of course that may well have happened. I mean, the big problem here, without involving your listeners in a whole load of accounting law and company law, is that Bristol 2015 Limited was set up by the council to deliver the programme for the European Green Capital Year. Now, the council itself is subject to freedom of information requests. There's also something called the Local Government Transparency Code, which was actually put in place while I was a minister in the Department of Communities and Local Government in February last year. And that code says that all items of expenditure above £500 and all contracts awarded by any local authority with a value of over £5,000, all the details have to be disclosed. And that's because that would enable people to come forward and say, well, we don't think that's good value for money. Someone else could have done that better. And it's taxpayers' money, so why shouldn't we know anyway in this sort of age of transparency? Now, Bristol City Council say that they've handed over £1 million worth of Bristol taxpayers' money, £7 million worth of national taxpayers' money to this company, and that means freedom of information doesn't apply, and also the Local Government Transparency Code doesn't apply, even though it's all public money. And I think that's an outrage, and that's why I'm continuing to pursue the Mayor and the Chief Executive of the Council until we get clear answers to some very straightforward questions.
George Ferguson, who was here, was saying, would say, Stephen, I'm no doubt that you're just politicking
because
there's local elections coming. Well, you're a Lib Dem, and you're just making it, stirring the pot because this is politically motivated.
Well, even if I was, which I'm not, but let's just play along with this game, Tony, and say I am politicking. Well, he could shoot my fox and whatever a metaphor you want at the moment and publish, couldn't he? There's a very easy answer to this. I'll ask directly on air now. Could someone, George Ferguson, if he's listening, or Nicola Yates, if she's listening, or any of the public relations people around them, I think there are 43 of them, after all, at Bristol City Council, so surely somebody monitors this programme. Why not tweet now who got £250,000 worth of taxpayers' money to set up a very straightforward website? Then one of my foxes would be shot. I've got several more, but at least one of them would be shot, and I'd shut up.
And if you wanted me to set up such a website, I would maybe charge a couple of grand, maybe.
Yeah, well, lots of people have said to me it could be done for 10% of the cost that's actually been disclosed so far. And this just leads people to suspect that somebody has done rather well out of this who may be linked to someone at the council.
You know what, this just reminds me, Martin, of just the way that big business operates. They don't have to disclose things to the public, and maybe what we're seeing here is simply the movement of the big business mindset into trying to run a local authority.
Well, it's the fundamental problem with the private finance initiative and etc. is when public money is engaged, I would argue that when public money is engaged, there's got to be complete transparency. But often that we're told that because it's commercially confidential, we're not allowed to know when public and private money are mixed together because there's commercial confidentiality involved. And I'd basically say, if you want public contracts, we want 100% transparency. You don't have to bid for those contracts. You don't, but if you do want to bid for them, we want to know exactly what the money's been spent on. And the creation of sort of quangos and third sector organisations, which sounds sort of very touchy-feely and friendly, you know, not the bureaucratic council, not private business, but something in between, well, that's actually a minefield or a swamp, isn't it? And I think actually the legal people in the council, when I worked for the council, were fairly clear that there was real problems with things like asset transfer to community groups, because these are public resources or public assets, and the idea that they can just be passed without proper accountability to third parties is simply wrong.
Some will say, Stephen, that actually you can run a local authority just like a business.
Well, there's nothing wrong with local councils being careful with public money and having some, you know, entrepreneurial go-getting officers working for them, as long as we know what they're doing. That's the issue here. It's, the money may well have been spent in good ways, but because they're refusing to give even quite basic information, like who got awarded contracts for this and that, we can't assess it. We're just told that it's had a massive impact. One of the laughable figures in the so-called audit report that I read from last November to the council says that 200,000 people have engaged with European Green Capital. Well, that's more than half the adult population of the city, and I think that's in itself a fairly risible claim. There's lots of other numbers bandied about in the council's reports as well that don't seem to have much backup to them.
The Bristol Post has said, forget about it. It's all gone. It all went last year. It's all happened. Everyone's happy. Why pick over old wounds?
Well, maybe you could get the editor of the Bristol Post in as a guest on your programme and ask him that question.
Actually. And Ian Onions, they don't reply.
Ian Onions, to be fair to him, has reported faithfully both my exchanges with the council so far. I've had a reply to my detailed questions yesterday evening, which I've been going over today, and just this afternoon I've published that reply from Nicola Yates on my blog, so people can go and have a look at that. But
I'll tell you what,
but it simply doesn't answer the question.
Would you like to just pricey your reply for us now, Stephen?
Well, what she's... I put a whole series of questions to them on February the 2nd, so it's taken them a month to reply. Most of my questions are unanswered, except to say that the Council's Audit Committee will be looking at this next week. The trouble with that is that the previous Audit Committee reports were so opaque and useless, that's what encouraged me to get involved in this in the first place. The report for next week has been published this afternoon, 45 pages, which I skim read before I left the house. And it adds nothing to what we, well, to what we didn't know before. So, for instance, who went to different conferences isn't disclosed. We now have a list of job titles, but not the individuals who went to Paris, possibly for up to a fortnight to the climate change conference. The website, I've mentioned already, there's something else that is actually on the website called the Bristol Method, where £138,000 worth of, again, taxpayers' money, it's not anybody else's money, it's our money, has gone to somebody to develop a knowledge sharing platform. Again, we can't be told who that is.
Martin, one of the things that the Bristol Cable pointed out back at the beginning of last year was that nearly £500,000 has been awarded by Bristol 2015 Limited to organisations with direct links to its board members. So that is basically the board members dishing it out to their own organisations, which is about a third of the total fund of £1.35 million. This is the particular fund they were looking at. And I just wonder what you make of this whole idea of, I mean, it does look as to me as if this is just business culture here. We've got this money, we can spend it how we want, and there is a complete ignoring of the idea that of any public accountability.
Well, I suppose the justification would be is that Bristol's got a fairly developed sustainability infrastructure, you know, Sustrans, etc. And it wouldn't be unreasonable for those people to be given the money, public money, to carry out various projects. But we ought to know who's been given it, and we ought to know what they've spent it on. It's fairly straightforward point, isn't it?
Stephen, also this week we've had a rather surprise decision by the planning committee to do with the arena that is has been being talked about for decades, actually. It's a pretty horrendous site, we all know that, but it's been pretty much cleared now, ready for this to go. You know what, when I saw this, I thought this is a bit like Hinkley, that loads of time and money has been invested in all the great announcements and plans, and isn't this going to be all wonderful? And then we're told at the last minute, hang on, this just will not work like this.
Yeah, well, what the planning committee decided to do, and of course this is a cross-party committee of city councillors that have to operate according to planning law and guidelines. It's not a political decision-making body. And what that cross-party committee from all four parties represented on the council decided to do was to defer decided on the application for another month because they thought the transport plans weren't robust enough. Not all the councillors voted for that, but all the Conservatives, most of the Labour councillors voted to defer. The Liberal Democrat councillors were willing to accept the assurances and to allow the building work to continue in the Greens were split. So the parties were a bit all over the place on it. But the point is, work can't start for at least another month.
What are your thoughts about the how useful and valid the arena is? Because it's using a lot of, again, public money. And I know we've had Lib Dems on here and others in the past questioning as to whether Bristol can really afford this. And, you know, because the repayments are going to be a long time down the line. I mean, I would personally suggest that if someone wanted to build an arena, why not a commercial organisation outside the council? Why does public money have to go into this?
Well, there will be a commercial operator, and potentially down the line, I can foresee a whole lot of other queries.
But
about,
look, hang on.
About,
the point here is, if a commercial operator could build this thing and have it going for the next 20, 30 years, possibly even longer into the future, why haven't they done it? Why should the public be expected to pay for this?
Well, I don't know of any sort of major conference, concert venue in the country that's been built entirely by private sector money. There's always an element of public sector support and maybe ultimately ownership in it. Personally, I think Bristol needs an arena and convention centre. It's a matter of shame as a city that our sporting facilities aren't a patch on Cardiff's or Birmingham's. Our concert facilities are pretty lacklustre as well. That's why I was pleased to support the investment programme for the Colston Hall, so that gets an auditorium fit for purpose at some point in the next few years. But the Colston Hall can only hold about 1,800 people, so that means a lot of big bands and productions bypass Bristol, and you have to go to Cardiff or Birmingham or London to watch them. Also, we miss out on a lot of sort of exhibitions, conferences and trade fairs that would come into the city, fill up the hotel rooms. All the bars and restaurants would do very well out of it. So
but they haven't
means we're missing out.
Well, they haven't done the work, have they? Emerged during the debate, says the article in the Post yesterday, that a travel plan had not been drawn up, which is required for any major new development. So they just haven't put the work in.
Yeah, which is quite remarkable, because, I mean, this is, as you said, has been a long running saga going back more than 10 years when the late and unlamented, as far as I'm concerned, Southwest Regional Development Agency cleared the site, which of course was an old diesel depot, so there was a lot of decontamination work had to be done there. A lot of public money was spent on that.
Royal Mail, Royal Mail sorting, giant.
That's next door. That's another big saga, which we can go on to if you want. But the arena site was an old rail depot, which did have to be decontaminated. That was done using public money. And now, sort of 8 years later, I think, 8 or 9 years after that happened, maybe something's finally going to happen. But it doesn't take a sort of transport planning genius or highways engineer genius to work out that if you've got 12,000 people watching Adele or the Kaiser Chiefs or whatever your chosen sort of popular act is that currently doesn't come to Bristol, leave the new arena at, let's say, 10:30 at night, that somehow they're all going to go away from the site on the number 70 bus, or maybe if you're lucky the 7 Beach line is still running at that time of night, or maybe the trains to London, maybe there's one left. Quite obviously there does need to be better public transport in the evening to help people, but also some car parking on site as well, so that residents nearby in Redcliffe, the Dings and Totterdown aren't turned into a huge free car park simply because the people behind the arena have not done their homework.
The transport issue is really actually quite important, isn't it? I mean, because all over the place I notice where there's a wonderful new development, it all looks great and wonderful, but it ends up like traffic chaos, a bit like Junction 2 on the M32. It's when IKEA turned up there, Everyone was saying it's going to be chaotic, traffic's no good. And of course what we now see is regularly cars tailing back right onto the motorway itself. And so this is actually quite important to get the travel plans right.
It is, and of course IKEA, I was a councillor at the time when we said that it would cause traffic problems because, given the business model, everyone pretty much arrives by car. At IKEA, you don't really take furniture home on the bus. But customers there are spread right from early in the morning to late at night. While there may be some peaks and troughs on the weekend, broadly the comings and goings are pretty well spread out. Whereas people leaving a concert, it's an event that happens over a half-hour period, often late in the evening. So you have to have good public transport in order to get people away. Now, the fact that the arena is going to be built right next to Bristol Temple Mead Station is helpful, but unless the trains are running late, people are just going to be looking at empty platforms and thinking, why can't I get the late train back to Swindon or back to Gloucester or Cheltenham or anywhere else?
Now, we're also joined by Bruce Williamson from Rail Futures. Is that right? Is that the name you use, Bruce?
Yeah, that'll do. Yeah, yeah. That's
Rail Futures.
No, singular.
Rail Future.
Yeah.
Now, I'm just wondering, is the expectation, do you think, with the arena that people are going to go by train? Because, of course, they're not, are they?
Well, a few will, but the railway infrastructure needs an awful lot of investment to sort of cope with that sort of demand. And I think, you know, that George and his other planners are sort of just magically assuming that if you make life difficult for drivers, that the alternatives will just appear by themselves, and they won't. David Wood, who writes a regular column in the Bristol Post, has been banging on about this quite a lot recently. You know, there's the station at Ashton Gate, which won't happen in the near future, and that would be an ideal candidate for bringing people into the arena. And of course the railway services.
Hang on, Ashton Gate to the arena?
Yeah.
Well, that's a bit of a trek, isn't it?
Well, if you live in South Bristol and you want to go to this new arena, then the railway will do it for you.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You're not to the Ashton Gate Stadium, but to the to the new arena. You know.
I mean, you could almost have sort of shuttle train going between somewhere a little bit outside the city and bringing people in, maybe.
Absolutely, you could. You need that infrastructure, but Metro West is part of that plan. You know, the opening the line to Portishead, which will all help, but there's an awful lot more that needs to be done. And as much as the politicians will bark on about Metro Bus isn't going to help.
I'd like to just get your take as well on what's happening with Metro Bus, because I know you're not a great fan of the whole project, but it does seem, and Stephen and I were just discussing this, that the amount of delays, and we've been told that the delays at the moment are going to be lasting the whole year, pretty much, that the delays and the congestion being caused by the Metro Bus works, when you sort of weigh that in the scales, in the balance, with what this is supposed to be saving over the next 10, 15 years, if it lasts that long, actually, we're losing out already.
Well, indeed, if you believe that Metro Bus was a good thing, which I don't, obviously, then you could argue that it's short-term pain for long-term gain. But it's short-term pain for virtually no gain whatsoever. It will have negligible impact on traffic and congestion in Bristol. We're trashing green spaces, valuable green spaces, to make, and pouring thousands of tons of concrete, which has a huge carbon cost in itself. And the end result is that you're just diverting some existing bus routes, and they may not even be any quicker. So that, the advantages of Metrobus are virtually zero, and we're blowing hundreds of millions of pounds on it. It's an absolute waste of money.
What would you do?
You would expect me to say this, but if you want decent public transport, and this is a crucial point, decent public transport that attracts people, it's got to be rail-based. And if you look at the other cities around the UK that have invested money, Nottingham's a really good example, Croydon, Manchester and so on, they've invested in tram systems, and those tram systems have been hugely successful in attracting passengers.
But we're not allowed to have a tram here.
Well, we're not allowed to have a tram because the government won't pay for it. Okay, so yeah, there is a central government aspect to this, but we nonetheless, I think, that local politicians should dig their heels in, recognise that the only way forward is a decent tram system, and keep pushing to make it happen.
Stephen, what's your take on this, and how have we come to a decision where we're hearing from Steve here, actually, and you're hearing it from me as well. It just seems it's causing far more trouble than it's ever going to give in benefit.
Well, I actually agree. As I mentioned earlier, I was an Avon councillor back in the early to late 1990s.
But how does decisions like this get made?
Well, Avon actually came up with a tram proposal. I remember it was called the Westway. There was even some nice brochures produced for it at the time. I still have them at home. And were in the process of bidding to central government, which, of course, was John Major's government at the time, in order to build the tram system. And then what I think was the most disastrous public sector decision made in the last 50 years in Bristol, that Avon was abolished, and we have four unitary authorities, a fragmentation of a travel to work natural economic unit that is Greater Bristol, with no strategic transport planning as a result of that. Those tram plans fell by the wayside while the new unitary authorities set themselves up, and in the meantime Manchester, Nottingham, Sheffield, Just to name three off the top of my head, I'm sure.
Croydon
into Sutton as well, were able to secure government money when there was plentiful government money at the tail end of Major's government and into the early years of Blair's government for such schemes. And by the time Bristol did get its act together, the money had run out.
I mean, it's a bit of a no-brainer. What you do is you get someone together who's chief of transport in each of the local authorities, Stephen, and you say, right, bang heads together and get them to do something.
Well,
you don't need to have even.
People might remember this, that there was a squabble in between Bristol and South Gloucestershire, an authority that I think should never have been created, over where the tram terminus should be, whether it should be at Cribbs Causeway, top of the M32, or somewhere else. And the big problem here is that the area that we all think of as Bristol, and anyone who's abroad and is asked, where do you live, if you live in Patchway or Filton or Kingswood, is going to say Bristol, and isn't going to say somewhere called South Gloucestershire. But we have that local government unit, and it's bedeviled transport planning ever since.
How do we fix this, though, Bruce?
Well, it's down to central government. I mean, it'd be interesting to sort of just quickly explain how this Metrobus has come about, because politicians, you know, look at the cost of a rail scheme and they look at the cost of a bus and they think, well, the bus is cheaper, we'll do that. Why can't we get buses to do the same job as trains and trams by making them guided?
Well, you can try. And I saw what happened to one in Cambridge recently, which was it came rather nastily off its rails.
It's done that several times.
Up in the woods, the driver came catapulted through the windscreen into the path of an oncoming one of these bus things. It's a bus that's trying to go down a little guided busway, but it doesn't always work.
Well, even if it does work, it still doesn't work in the sense that it doesn't attract passengers, and that's what a public transport system should do. So politicians, you know, mistakenly think that buses and trains are equivalent and they'll do the same job and the buses are cheaper, so let's invest money in buses. And they wanted to do this. You know, they twisted the arm of Cambridge and Bristol, I think, to you know, implement the Metrobus. The Metrobus was a scheme designed to chase funding. There is no public transport rationale behind the Metrobus. It's just like, what do we have to do to get this funding? And let's do this. And that's why it will be a failure. The politicians will stick with it for 10 years until everyone has changed jobs. And then the new politicians can say, oh, we knew it was a disaster right from the start. What we need is a tram system. But the problem is, in the meantime, we will have wasted public money. We'll be lumbered with this half-assed public transport system that doesn't work, and we will have lost some green space. And that's, you know, that's 20th century politics, really, 21st century politics.
What we could be doing, a tram system is quite difficult and expensive to get going on the streets from scratch, you know, because all the lines were torn up in the 1930s, whenever it was. But we do still have a heavy rail infrastructure around the city used for freight, but not used for transport. And I was arguing for years while I was both a councillor and a member of parliament that we should be reopening the line out to Portishead, that we should be having more frequent services on the Seven Beach line, and we should have a sort of circle line, a Henry Loop as some people call it, in Bristol as well, with the rail line that runs in between Filton and Avonmouth, roughly across the top of the city, should be reopened to passenger traffic. Now, that's likely to happen at some point in the next few years. Portishead is definitely going to happen, but after about 15 years worth of people saying it was the obvious thing to do.
Well, one of the wonderful things about all this congestion is it's ripe for someone to come along and say, hey, Bristol needs a congestion charge.
Well, you know, that's not necessarily a bad idea. You know, personally, I would prefer it to the residence parking zones, which I hate. And the congestion charge, actually, I take that back. It was a different charge. In Nottingham, to fund the trams, they imposed a workplace parking charge. At least a congestion charge is sort of punishing those who are causing the problem rather than the innocent residents who are doubly hit. But, yeah, I mean, the reality is, you know, if you want decent public transport, you've got to pay for it one way or another, and whether it's congestion charging or taxation or whatever, you know, these things don't come cheap. But if you invest that money, then you build it, they will come, as the old saying goes, and it's true.
Well, okay, Bruce Williamson. Also, you do your just plug your. Okay, no, he does another program. You may have recognised his voice. I'll leave that to you folks to figure out. We'll move on to look at the a report out this week. Focus on Islamic terror plots overlooks threat from the far right. Britain leads any other European country for the sheer number of attacks or plots over the last 15 years that have been planned by individuals or self-starting cells, according to the analysis conducted jointly by four research institutes. Threat from the far-right terrorist is being neglected by governments and law enforcement, according to the most extensive survey yet of lone actors in Europe. The report is by experts from the Royal United Services Institute, Chatham House, Institute for Strategic Dialogue and the University of Leiden in the Netherlands. Stephen, I wonder what you make of this. What they're saying effectively is out of 124 perpetrators on their database, 38% were religiously inspired, 33% were far-right extremists. The authors of the report said they're surprised by the finding, given the focus nationally in the press and during using this prevent strategy on Islamic extremism, which is actually only just about the same as that extremism from the far-right, apparently.
Well, I wouldn't agree that the threat from Islamic extremism is about the same, as you said, from the far right, however you define the far right.
I mean, what they're saying is that that's what the statistics prove. For example, there was the attack on Lee Rigby that then led to loads of far right attacks.
Yes, in response. I mean, I can tell you, as I was the Communities Minister for 2 years, I was quite close to this from 2013 to 2015, that government does monitor what far-right groups are up to, because I used to see the reports, and we certainly had concern about, I think there was a group called Britain First that would sort of turn up at mosques and hand out Bibles and intimidate people and so on.
And then
we certainly kept an eye on
Britain First. We were talking about this last week, because Britain First turned up just a few months before at this mosque in Rochdale, and then an old fellow who worked at the mosque was murdered just a couple of weeks ago at this place where Britain First had turned up.
Yes, and these people are a problem, and they're obviously trying to foment community discord and to get people being suspicious of their neighbours. They have a political agenda there. The threat from Islamic extremists who have a perverted view of Islam, whether they're linked to ISIS or Al-Qaeda or in any other terrorist groups, is obviously far more serious in terms of threat to life and limb, both in this country and abroad, or indeed tempting young people from this country. We're broadcasting from right next door to City Academy School, where a young girl last year or the year before, of course, disappeared. We think probably off to Syria and into the arms of a radical group. So there is a big threat from extremist Islamic groups, and we certainly shouldn't be turning a blind eye to it or equating it to other groups that are a problem but not quite so fundamental.
Aren't you jumping to conclusions there if we're not actually sure where this girl went?
Well, I'm not going to go into the ins and outs of what is known about the travel plans of that girl, particularly as I'm not, for the last 8 months, I've not been in office, so I'm not close to what is currently known. But there is undoubtedly an ongoing campaign by ISIS to groom vulnerable young people in Britain, both young men and young women, to go abroad to take part in a perverted view of jihad, either to fight directly or to support those who are fighting. That is a big problem. We know of one girl from Bristol who may well have gone down that route, but there are other documented cases, of course, so-called Jihadi John and other people who have definitely gone down that route, and it is a very real threat.
Yeah, her name is Yusra Hussein, and most of the reporting on her says they think she has gone, except the Daily Mail seems to be the only newspaper that's saying definitely she did fled Bristol to join ISIS. Martin, what do you make of all this? Because the balance is in this report is actually the far right threat is pretty much equivalent to Islamic extremism.
Well, we know from historical investigations by the police in Italy and elsewhere, that NATO intelligence services have historically been involved in promoting both right and left-wing terrorism. So in Italy, for example, the police investigations, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, Fernando Imposimato, has written a book about this, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. And what was going on in the Strategia di Tensione in Italy was that they were actually encouraging both fascist and far left groups like the Red Brigade
to destabilise the situation. How does this relate to Bristol now?
But there's two other things I'd like to bring up in this context. You know, the other day, David Cameron accused Jeremy Corbyn of being a terrorist sympathiser, but there has been recently a case at the Old Bailey where a gentleman who was being charged by the West Midlands Police with attempting to go to Syria to join one of these groups, and his lawyers argued quite successfully that the group he was going to join was in fact being armed and trained by MI6, and the case was dropped. In Turkey itself, the civilian police stopped a truck, a convoy of supposedly humanitarian aid crossing the border into Syria. They investigated. It was packed with weaponry by the MIT, which is the Turkish intelligence services, and they attempted to prosecute the people concerned. Now, what's actually happened in Italy is that Erdogan, the president, has overruled the police. He has sent the police officers who carried out the raid, he's putting them on trial for treason, and he's also putting on two journalists on trial who reported on this.
Okay, Martin, can you bring it back to today?
The fundamental point I'm making is that all the evidence around Syria suggests that NATO intelligence services working with the Saudis and the Turks have been arming and training jihadi terrorists inside Syria. That is certainly the contention of the Syrian government and the Russian general staff and the Iranian general staff. You don't hear about this on Radio 4, but in Turkey, everybody knows that this is what goes on. In Turkey, the Ergonikon networks, which were embedded...
Well, can I just say, in Turkey, not everybody knows, because quite a lot of the journalists who've reported this have actually been arrested. There are two I know in jail.
They're arresting these journalists because ordinary people in Turkey are very well aware that the state is up to its eyeballs in supporting jihadi terrorism. They are our NATO allies, as are our Saudi allies, who are busily bombing in Yemen at the moment using our military personnel and our weaponry. And, of course, the far right, like it was also being pushed in the 70s and the 80s to carry out atrocities in Italy. We've got documented evidence going back decades for this sort of thing. And I'm afraid that what's happened in Syria actually exposes what has been going on. Since the 1980s, Western intelligence services, led by MI6 as the lead agency on Operation Cyclone, have been arming and training jihadi terrorists. For example, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group in Libya, Al-Qaeda Libya, armed and trained by British military personnel. There's no dispute about this. These are the facts.
Okay,
but the facts are not really discussed in the mainstream media.
But they are certainly in this fascinating report from the Royal United Services Institute, not known for its veering away from the sort of NATO military doctrine and strategy. Martin, what do you make of this? What they're saying is that attacks are considered lone attacks, even if they involved up to three people, as long as the individual or group was acting without an order to act from outside, or direct support in planning, preparation and execution of the attack. I mean, when they say without direct support in planning, preparation and execution of the attack, an intelligence agency of whatever country has the ability to make that support indirect.
Indeed, and in actual fact, there's a historical record of them doing exactly that. Going back, I mean, as I say, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, Fernando Imposimato, the senior judge in Italy,
you've said that.
The investigating magistrate on all of these cases, the kidnapping of Aldo Moro, the bombing of Bologna railway station, the police in Italy are absolutely clear. NATO intelligence services, SISMI in the first place, the Italian Secret Service working with MI6, CIA.
But we're talking about Bristol tonight.
No, we're talking about Bristol. I'm talking about Bristol. What we really need here is an independent investigation by democratically accountable police officers of the activities of the intelligence services. I just mentioned what happened in the Old Bailey, where a gentleman who was going to Syria to join one of these groups was able to defend himself successfully by arguing that the group he was going to join was supported by MI6, and it was MI6 who put him up to it. The case was dropped.
What do you make of what Martin's saying here, Stephen?
I don't know what to make of what Martin's saying, except it doesn't have much to do with what we're supposed to be discussing. It is important that government, through our intelligence agencies and special branch and other people, do keep an eye on the activities of people, whether they're motivated by extremism, an extremist view of Islam, or whether they have a far-right view. And I think that's what the report is saying, that more weight should be given to monitoring far-right activities. From what you're saying, you have the advantage over me that you may have read the report, and I haven't, so I'm only taking from
actually,
you.
I've only read this in the Guardian.
We're in danger of having a discussion about geopolitical situation here with our friend.
What Martin's the relevant point I think Martin is making is that the intelligence services right across the world, and without accepting our own, are just not accountable enough.
Well, intelligence services are accountable to Parliament. Both MI5 and MI6 are accountable to a committee of senior members of Parliament. That committee obviously meets when it's discussing the day-to-day operations of both MI5 and MI6. Can't do that in the open, but it is a cross-party committee. They are senior parliamentarians, and it is a serious job.
We've seen
just the same, in the United States Senate.
With Edward Snowden, GCHQ have been running rings around the politicians and doing virtually what they want without any proper scrutiny.
I don't think that is fair, and I'm not a great fan of Edward Snowden and what he's done. It's very easy to blow the whistle and then run to Russia for protection.
Well, I mean, if he hadn't done that, he would probably be in jail, wouldn't he?
But I believe that all democracies have always needed an intelligence agency in order to protect the fundamental civil liberties of all of us. A lot of what they will do, yes, has to be clandestine. It might involve activities that the rest of us would really rather not personally get involved in, but I'm rather glad that there are people out there who put their lives on the line in order to protect our civil liberties. And I think the people at GCHQ, people in MI5, and MI6 and Special Branch are doing an important job of work on behalf of all of us so that we can have discussions such as this without risk of being shot when we get out into the yard, or in my case being thrown off the roof because my sexuality is wrong.
Olof Palme was shot, wasn't he? It's 30 years since he was shot.
He was the Swedish Prime Minister.
He should
have had more bodyguards.
Probably, yeah. Also, what do you make of the Snoopers Charter? Because that's coming up again, isn't it? It was sort of contradicted what you've just said,
yeah,
possibly, because I know the Lib Dems are very much against it.
Absolutely. There always has to be a balance. Every time the police and the other security agencies come forward with a request for new powers, it is the duty of politicians to scrutinise that request and see whether it is reasonable. Now, when we were in coalition government in between 2010 and 2015, we did not allow Theresa May, the Home Secretary, to give the security agencies everything that they asked for. Now that we're out of government and the Conservatives are in government on their own, Theresa May looks very likely to go the whole hog on what was dubbed the Snoopers Charter back in 2012.
I mean, many people are saying, Stephen, that all that's happening here is that GCHQ have been doing this kind of thing for years, and they're now bringing what was previously criminal, potentially anyway, criminal activity within the law by making sure this charter goes through.
Possibly. I mean, we can all speculate about this, but just consider something that is very much in the news today. I'm holding up, this is radio, not TV, I'm holding up my rather nice yellow Apple iPhone, which has a 4-digit code for me to access that no one else can use, because there's a case in the United States at the moment where a terrorist's phone is being held by the FBI, but they can't look at what's on it.
Interesting, because the reason Apple have given is that they have said that this could and probably would fall straight into the hands of organised crime, which doesn't say a lot for the
It doesn't say much about Apple's internal security or the FBI's.
It doesn't say a lot for the FBI, does it? And on that subject, there was a question at Prime Minister's Questions this week about gangsters. Basically about this law of joint enterprise, and I think it was Stuart Andrew MP that asked it.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In 2004, the 16-year-old son of my constituent, Lorraine Fraser, was murdered by a gang, and the conviction of four of them was secured through joint enterprise. The recent ruling in the Supreme Court has caused Lorraine and many other victims' families a great deal of anxiety. Would my right honourable friend agree to facilitate a meeting to enable these families to discuss their concerns with ministers and understand what the ruling might mean in cases like theirs?
Well, through my honourable friend, can I extend my sympathy to his constituents? And he's absolutely right. We should begin by remembering the families of all those who've lost loved ones to dreadful crimes, who are worried about this judgment and what it might mean for them. I'm very happy to facilitate the meeting between him and one of the justice ministers to discuss it. I think we should be clear this judgment only referred to a narrow category of joint enterprise cases, and I think it would be wrong to suggest that everyone convicted under the wider law on joint enterprise will have grounds for appeal. I think it's very important that message goes out, but I'll fix the meeting that he calls for.
Well, I mean, obviously, we were talking about getting the balance right here. I mean, with things like this, it's going to be a judgment call, isn't it? What is joint enterprise? But I come back to what I was saying earlier. I'm afraid NATO intelligence services have a massive track record of fomenting terrorism. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, headed by Abdul Hakim Belhaj, which overthrew Gaddafi, is Al-Qaeda Libya.
Martin, the question is about gang killings
gangsterism in Russia. I used to live in Russia, I used to live in Poland, I used to work in Russia. Gangsterism is a major problem all over the world. It's a major problem in Mexico. The Fast and Furious investigation into the FBI, which was being carried out by an independent judiciary in the US, shows that the FBI have actually been supplying weaponry to various drug cartels which they're in alliance with, in order to rub out the drug cartels that they're not in alliance with. Everybody knows about this stuff in Texas. Do they know about it in Bristol?
Anyway, Stephen, what do you make of this change in the law to do with joint enterprise?
As I understand it, I'm not a lawyer, but joint enterprise means that while somebody may be the principal person who, for instance, murders someone, if they've got someone on the scene who at least doesn't intervene to stop it or in some way helps the person who actually administered the fatal blow, then they can be caught by the law of joint enterprise. As I understand it, there's now going to be a review of whether that is still valid going forward. So
okay.
Let's wait and see what the review says.
Final story. Looks like UK house builders are restricting the supply of new homes to keep prices unnecessarily high. Largest developers accused of profiteering on the back of the country's housing crisis by restricting supply of new houses. Figures reveal a record 500,000 homes in England now have planning permission granted, but have yet to be built.
Yes, this is a problem. I mean, it's a very big problem in Bristol. Affordability for people who are trying to get their first foot, their foot on the first run of the housing ladder to either buy or rent, and prices are extraordinarily high. And that's simply because not enough new homes have been built, not just in the last 5 years, but in the last probably 30 or 40 years, in order to catch up with changes in the population. Obviously, the population is growing because people are living longer. It's also more fragmented. People are living sort of separate lifestyles rather than families staying together. So we need more housing units. Not enough have been built in total, but also not enough purpose-built accommodation for elderly people is being built. There's a lot of elderly people living in family homes who would quite like to move into accommodation that is more suitable for them, say in their 70s and 80s, that has grab rails in the bathroom, level access and so on. And not enough of this has been built.
Martin,
and that's where major contribution could be made.
Martin, what do you make of this? Half a million homes unbuilt.
Well, this question of affordability is like a piece of soap in the shower, isn't it? What is affordability?
Every time I hear the word affordable housing, I now translate it in my head to unaffordable housing.
Well, certainly unaffordable for most people. The bottom third of the population simply cannot buy their own houses. They never were able to. That's why we had council houses.
What's really the cause of this, I suppose? The house is something that we all need. It's one of the things that people put their money into when the stock market looks as if it's a bit iffy. We had Mervyn King this week saying there's going to be another crash, boys and girls, and so people are going to invest in housing. Everyone wants to put their money into houses, which means effectively that the price is going through the roof.
Well, it's a bubble, isn't it, which is going to crash, as Mervyn King's pointed
out. What do you think, Stephen?
I don't think it's a bubble. If there was a bubble, we'd have lots of things being built and no one buying them. So there's certainly not a bubble.
Go down to Finsall's Reach and have a look down there. Anyway, time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest, former Bristol West MP Stephen Williams. After the news, the transfer agreement between the Zionists and Hitler.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an